Welcome back as we continue to learn how to lead together. You'll notice the title for this session, it's your leadership style. We've been looking at your personality, we've been looking at your personal mission in life, and hopefully you've given some thought to that. And now I want to look at some various ways that you can lead, styles of leadership. And we're going to look at a couple of different quantifications of styles. But as we begin this, I want you to be aware that you don't use just one style if you're a good leader. That various situations require different styles of leadership. And your style of leadership is highly dependent on the situation you are in, the culture you are in. And we'll talk more about that when we get to culture. But again, now it's just the diagram, not the definition today, but the leader interacting with culture to develop a vision and then giving the impetus to working that out, to finding God's mission in their life. So, and then the words, but now leadership styles. This listing comes from a book called The Making of a Christian Leader by a man named Ted Engstrom. As he looked at leaders around his world, he said there are these four basic styles about how a person can move people forward. The first one, laissez-faire, you may recognize as a statement of government. Laissez-faire is anything goes, or the people are self-directed. In other words, the leader gives minimum direction and provides maximum freedom to the people. And the people just kind of go where they're going to go. The leader kind of recedes into the background. Now, there's a good question on the part of some, is that really leadership? And in some senses, it can be. For instance, one pastor here in the United States felt called to be a writer and speaker, and he was spending so much time in the bureaucracy of the church that he was having a difficult time doing that. And so, you know, there were these meetings and those meetings, and there was the pastoral care issues, and there were the decisions to make because there was a building expansion thing going on, and committees to be part of, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, he went to the elders of his church and just said, you know, I don't feel like I'm fulfilling God's mission in my life because I'm so busy with these things. And so the elders of that church said, you know what, you're right. They affirmed his mission, and they said, okay, we're setting you free. Now, you don't have to come to a meeting again. You preach, you lead us through your preaching, you write, and lead us through your writing, and we'll take care of all the details of ministry. And so that's what they did. Now, that church didn't grow hugely. You may know the person I'm talking about. His name is Eugene Peterson, somebody who wrote the best-known paraphrase of the Bible. He's written many books. He was incredibly productive during that time. His church was relatively small to medium-sized, 300 people in attendance. In that sense, that was a laissez-faire approach to leadership. Now, sometimes in the business world, this can become a very effective way. If you've got really motivated people, this can become a very effective style of leadership. Google, for instance, has a highly structured leadership structure, but they give people time because they know they've hired all these great, creative, motivated people. And so what they do is they build in 10% of their time is to be spent thinking outside the box. And they can do that collaboratively, they can do it by themselves, and do it however it fits their personality and their gifting, etc. And so these people are just thinking up ideas. Now, Google has some big stuff on the long-range planning, things that they want to get done, things that they want to accomplish, things that they want to change in their business model. But they give these people that freedom, and some big things have come out of that. Did you know that that's how Gmail started? A couple of people got together and started talking about the email servers that existed up to that point and said, you know, those could be improved. If we could just figure out a way to do this, 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 and this, man, we'd have something that would really be helpful out there and would go in the marketplace. And it was came as a result of a laissez-faire kind of situation where they said, oh, let's go do it. Now, again, they had to bring that to the leadership and get it approved, but it came out of these people who were well-motivated doing what they wanted to do. Now, laissez-faire only works if you have people who are incredibly motivated and really want to get something done. Democratic participative. The democratic process is exactly what it says it is. People are engaged in making the decisions. Now, in some respects, democracy is rather new on the face of world history. You know, the Greeks had it way back when, in their cities, when they had the citizens who were able to vote, and they were able to come to these citywide meetings, and they would impact the public policy. But when the United States began, and they began with a democracy, a representative democracy, it was rather new, because up until that point, decisions were made by the people who were the nobles or the royalty. It was the king or queen saying, this is what we're going to do. And at a lower level, it was the noble who was defining what you could do and what you couldn't do. And it was the king and the nobles who owned all the land, and the rest of the people barely had opportunity to give any input into a decision. It was not theirs to do. It was the part of the royalty. Now, the royalty supposedly had noblesse oblige, or the obligation of the nobility, but many times they did not. When the United States got started, they decided they didn't want a king. They wanted the people to be involved in making decisions. And so how did we do that? Well, they created this system through the U.S. Constitution. Now, there's an interesting side note to that, and that is there's really almost a theological understanding that underpins a democracy, and that is that we don't believe that people are by nature inherently good. Because everybody who's in our government has checks and balances. The president can't just do whatever he wants. There's a check and balance on him through the Supreme Court, the Senate, the House of Representatives. And neither one of those bodies by themselves can make long-lasting decisions. There's a check and a balance there, recognizing that people are not by nature all good. They have a tendency toward bad, and they can become selfish very quickly. And so you can see that in dictators and that sort of thing. So we created this system that has worked various times fairly well. So a democratic participative style of leadership, wherever you are, organization or church, that's the setting I know it from, asks the people to be involved. And then the leader helps them define what they want and helps them get the energy and the impetus to move forward toward those things that they've decided. Now, the positive thing about this style of leadership is that the people are engaged. They're committed. They are participating because they want to be part of this. And the negative is people have to be engaged. People can't just be sitting on the sidelines and have an organization work well with these kind of people. So you're going to be in a democratic, you're going to use a democratic style. You use it when people are really motivated to be part of the solution, that they are responsible, they're taking on responsibility, that they are able to be independent and don't need always you there defining the future, and that they have necessary knowledge and experience to make good decisions. In those type of situations, this works very well. Now, in other situations, it doesn't work well because people aren't equipped to be part of that process. You'll notice the next one, benevolent, autocratic. This is characterized by a father-like concern on the part of the leader. The leader is somebody who's in charge, and he identifies closely with the group, certainly. He's part of the group, and he wants to keep them happy, but he has the power, basically, but he operates benevolently. Now, this goes way back to Plato. Plato said that the ideal form of government would be the benevolent dictator, somebody who is kind and wants the good of the people, but somebody who's given power. You see, in a democratic participative situation, things can just kind of grind back to mediocrity very quickly if nobody's giving direction to it, because everybody's got to have their say, and you've got to work through consensus, some people believe, and then things will just grind to a halt. Whereas if you've got a benevolent, autocratic form, if people are accepting it, decisions can be made quickly, directions can be set quickly. Some groups of people thrive on this kind of leadership. Now, I didn't realize this in my first church. As I said, it was a group of people who all had blue-collar jobs, and they really wanted a leader who would tell them what to do, tell them where to go. And I was trying to create this democratic participative process so that they would be engaged in the process, and they would own the process. And they went to work every day and had people tell them what to do, and they really needed that as well. And so we kind of missed each other. Now, in part of my studies in church growth years ago, it's this style that was defined as the one that's able to make the church grow the fastest. When we relocated in Southern California, we sold the building that we had first made, the first building that the church had ever owned, sold it to another church. It was kind of an independent church, but they had a whole different structure than we did. You know, I was the lead pastor of that church. We had staff, but we also had these highly educated, competent leaders who were volunteering in various situations. So we're going to sell our building to this various group, and it was fascinating to watch the difference, because I would come into meetings with the chairman of our building planning team, with the chairman of our finance team, with some members of the building planning team, and so I'd have 6-7 people on my side of the table, and Pastor Duke would come in, and it was him and his brother-in-law who was the administrator for the church. And so they had the authority to make decisions right then and there. They didn't have to consult with the board because Pastor Duke was it. Later on, my youngest daughter wanted to get married in that church building since she had so many good memories of it. And so I went over there to say, what does it cost to rent this church building? And, you know, they had a check with Pastor Duke first. he was somebody who controlled things well, but the church was growing because he was gathering people who were used to that kind of leadership and that style, and thrived on it. And so they were getting great things done because decisions could be made easier. Now, am I advocating for this? Not necessarily. It depends on the culture where you are serving, the people you are serving. And just want this in your tool bag to realize that there are times when to be a benevolent dictator is not all that bad and can be used as a style positively. Now, one step further is the autocratic, bureaucratic person. The autocratic person is somebody who says, I'm in charge, no matter what. You know, there was a church years ago cartoon in some magazine, and I don't remember the magazine, but I remember the cartoon. It was a pastor who was asked, what's your org chart for your church? And he drew a great big circle, and he said, me. Wrote me in it, and then he wrote all little circles underneath that represented everybody else in the church. That's the autocrat. That's the person who says, this is me. I don't answer to anyone. There are no boards in this kind of church. The leader is the one who creates the rules. You'll see this in entrepreneurs often, this kind of personality and style. You see it in church planters often because they have to be that way in order to get something done, that this is the way it's going to be. This is especially a useful style in an emergency kind of situation or crisis situation. You'll find that when churches are falling apart and there's inter-warfare, and when a strong leader, like a benevolent autocratic leader, has left, it usually leaves a huge vacuum. And then somebody's got to come in to help meld together various parts of that organization or that church. And that's when the autocratic, bureaucratic style works well. So that's one way of looking at this idea of style. Now, again, there's not one that's better than another, but in reality, as a leader, you should be thinking about what style will work where I am. What works best? What has worked for me? What is the culture of this place? And we'll, of course, get to define that in the future. Here's another way of looking at it from Daniel Goleman, a more contemporary book, Leadership That Gets Things Done. Now, here's another group of styles, and you can choose the one that fits you best or the one you can choose to fit you best. The pace-setting leader is the person who comes and basically says, do as I do. In other words, they're somebody who takes a group of people along. He isn't somebody who stands up and preaches and says, you know, we should be sharing Jesus Christ with every house in this community. He doesn't do that. What he does is he says, you know, Tuesday night I'm going out calling. Who would like to come with me? Who would like to learn how to do this? Do as I do. Or you're getting that first staff person and you're walking, you know, together in this wonderful mission of your organization, and you're saying to this person, okay, here's what I do in this situation, so that they are trained. The authoritative leader is the one who says, come with me, but it's with me. I'm the one. The affiliative leader is the one who says, people come first. And so even before a direction is set within an organization, they will be learning a relationship with people. And the effective leader in that process identifies the key people to have a relationship with. And so you'll find affiliative leaders in churches, especially toward the beginning of a time, this is a great style to say, who's the influential people in this church? And make a point of getting to know them. Find out what their heart is for the church. Begin to learn, and as those people come first, you'll be able to get visions for the future of what God is calling that church or that organization to become. The coaching leader is working and establishing more leaders, and so they are somebody who says, try this. The coercive leader is, do what I tell you to do. That's the authoritative guy who says, whether it's right or wrong, you do what I tell you. This is how armies function, right? You've got a rank, and if you are ranked low, you don't question your orders. You do what I do. The coercive leader is that. And the democratic leader is, what do you think? Now, these are just a different way to put the ones that we talked about earlier. One more statement of how this can work. Okay, the style is listed on across the top board, coercive, authoritative, affiliative, democratic, pace setting, and coaching. And then you'll look below. How does the leader operate? Well, in a coercive one, he demands immediate compliance. In the authoritative, he mobilizes people toward a vision. In the affiliative, he creates harmony and builds emotional bonds. In the democratic, he forges consensus through participation. In the pace setting one, he sets high standards for performance. And in the coaching one, he develops people for the future. The style and a phrase, as we saw, do what I tell you, come with me, people come first, what do you think, do as I do now, try this. Underlying emotional intelligence competencies. Now, emotional intelligence, they found, is more important even than skill in the business world. How you interact with people is very important. So what drives these people, these types of leaders, these styles of leadership, what drives them? The coercive is a drive to achieve and to a self-initiative and self-control. The authoritative is self-confidence, empathy, change, and to be a catalyst of change. The affiliative, to have empathy, build relationships, communication is vitally important. Democratic is collaboration and team leadership and communication. Pace setting is conscientiousness, drive to achieve, initiative once again. And then the coaching is a deep desire to develop others. And a self-awareness, but one that gives empathy to others. When the style works best, coercive in a crisis to kickstart a turnaround or problem employees. Authoritative, when changes require a new vision or when a clear direction is needed. Affiliative, to heal rifts in a team or to motivate people during stressful circumstances. Democratic, to build buy-in or consensus or get input from valuable employees. Pace setting, to get quick results from a highly motivated and competent team. And coaching, to help an employee improve performance or develop long-term strengths. Overall impact on the climate. The coercive has an overall negative impact. It can only be used for a short time successfully. Authoritative is most strongly positive. The affiliative is positive. The democratic has positives to it. The pace setting is negative overall. It works in certain situations with certain people. And coaching is positive for the long term, not necessarily for the short term. Now, all of that comes down to this, you as the leader. How do you use your time? What do you define as the way of setting your schedule for the day and your priorities? Somebody who looked at this a long time ago is a man named Vilfredo Pareto. He was an Italian economist. And back in the late 1800s, he developed what has become known as the Pareto Principle, or the 80-20 Principle. Now, he said what he noticed was that in Italy, as he was looking at the economy of Italy, he saw that 20% of the people owned 80% of the wealth. And then he began looking at that same kind of percentage that as he looked at these percentages, he saw a correlation often that 20-80. For instance, he noted that 80% of the results come from 20% of the efforts. 80% of the activity of a company will produce only 20% of its resources. 80% of the usage of something is done by 20% of users, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you can apply this to the church. When you apply the Pareto principle to the church, you find that there are just some truths there. 80% of your income probably comes from 20% of your people. 20% of your people are probably doing 80% of the work within your church. 80% of the complaints probably come from 20% of the people or less. Crises are developed among the 80%, not the 20%, etc. Now, the purpose for me sharing that is as you look at your styles of leadership, you've got to realize that you can be distracted from the important stuff by the less important stuff. For instance, where are you spending 80% of your time? Often it will be with the people who are going to help you less in achieving the vision and mission of the church. It will be the people who are complaining. It'll be the problems that come up. It will be a variety of things that I think are tools of the enemy, frankly, after this long in ministry, that will just distract you from moving on and helping the organization move on toward the future. Talked with a church leader yesterday and frustrated because he had this vision for where the church should go, but there was a family in the church that was just causing all sorts of difficulties. Somebody who had accused him of saying something that he hadn't said, or he had said it in a certain context, and as a result they called the elders, and the elders had a meeting with the pastor, and the pastor is sitting there saying, that's not what I said, and on and on. And hours spent dealing with this complaint rather than doing the activities necessary and working with the people who are going to help get the vision into reality. Now, when I entered ministry, as I shared in introducing myself, I thought my job was to be the chaplain, the pastor, the shepherd to everybody. And so whatever need came up, I was the one I wanted people to turn to. And so whatever their situations, I ended up bringing people in for alcohol rehab. I ended up taking people into hospitals. I ended up doing all that side of work. Good work, wonderful work for the people, but it took my time and energy, and I wasn't putting that time and energy into helping figure out how was that church going to define its preferable future and move on to that preferable future, and who in the church was going to be part of the process of doing that. And so it just became a frustrating process. In my last church, we went through a period that I hopefully will talk about in the future of this class, known as the Whitewater period or the Pioneer Homesteader conflict. It's a time of conflict in an organization or a church when the people who have been there, the number of people who have been there, is met in number or equal in number to those who have come since the leader came, the pastor came. Well, we hit that part in California, and it was whitewater. It was just complaints coming from various places, and I was spending more and more of my time and emotional energy dealing with people who were unhappy about this, that, or another thing because things were changing. And the elders of my church, as we talked about this, took an unusual move. I've never heard about it done the same way since. They said to me, "You are no longer to take complaints. Somebody calls you, writes you a letter, emails you, whatever. They turn it over to these two people." Two of their elders were designated as those who would field the complaints and deal with them. And that freed up my time and emotional energy to work toward the things we had agreed upon were the future of the church. So as you look at the styles of leader, remember that you have to give time to them. You've got to give time to thinking about which is the best course right now in the situation you're facing with the future you're trying to define. And God will bless that. God will bless that. And hopefully the kingdom will be built. Will some people be unhappy? Yes, they will be. Now that's tough, especially for people like me. I know my family of origin created me to be a people pleaser, somebody who needs approval. You may be that way too. Many of us who entered into ministry are defined that way, by the way, by psychological tests. And so I've got to know that if I'm going to really be part of God's kingdom-building activity, I want to do it well, and I don't want to be distracted. And so find ways to use your time effectively and your styles effectively, And God is going to bless you as an effective leader.